You're listening to Nick Luck Daily. This edition is brought to you by Timeform, the trusted source of racing data and analysis, by the Racehorse Owners Association, and by the Racing App, in partnership with FitzDares. Hi there, welcome to the show, up bright and early here in TW11 on Wednesday, March the 20th. Since you were last with us, it was announced that Kieran Schumacher would ride Emily Upjohn in the Dubai Shima Classic Saturday week, replacing her regular partner, Frankie Dettori. John Shack, co-owner of Emily Upjohn, explains why later in the programme. The man that bought the filly is Tom Goff. We're not doubling up here, we're talking to Tom because he was one of four racing representatives to get behind the door of 10 Downing Street yesterday, the others being Joe Somerez-Smith, the BHA chair, the chief executive of ARC, Martin Cruddas, and Emily Upjohn's trainer, John Gosden. What did they achieve? Find out in a little while. While we're on racing politics, what is the task facing the new chief executive of France Gallo, Elie Hennaut? Our correspondent, Adrien Cugnas, from Jour de Gallo, explains all. We're checking in with J.A. McGrath in Hong Kong, plus I'll be talking to the chief regulatory officer of the BHA brand, Dunn Shea, first about the cock-up that befell the sport at Wolverhampton last night when a man who'd ridden 56 winners in the last year was able to ride at a fixture that was restricted to riders who'd ridden 30 or fewer winners in the past 12 months. He explains how that happened and whether it's likely to happen again, and he also gives his views on the article penned by Dr. Richard Newland, Grand National winning trainer, which invited all sorts of drawn inferences and was published by RacingTV.com yesterday. Jonathan Harding is the award-winning writer for the Racing Post. How has Dr. Newland poked the hornet's nest, Jonathan?
Well, Nick, this was a quite extraordinary piece published yesterday. And in that piece, Richard Newland says that he doesn't think his ideas will be popular with everybody. And I'm not sure he quite realised how right he would be. The backlash for this on social media has been quite extraordinary. So the piece is really his thoughts musing on the Irish dominance in British jumps racing, prompted by the Cheltenham Festival, of course, and what he feels ought to be done to tackle the challenges that face British jumps racing. He begins by, quite rightly, I would suggest, pointing out the fact that there are a lot of Irish trainers now targeting races in the UK, including outside of the Cheltenham Festival, whereas, relatively speaking, very few British trained horses make the trip over to Ireland to win their prize money. He points out that a lot of major owners are going over to have their horses trained in Ireland and then running them here as opposed to having them trained in Britain. Again, it's an interesting point. It then starts to go a little bit off tangent and a little bit provocative, where he's suggesting that a recent collaboration between the BHA and IHRB on anti-doping suggests that the BHA doesn't have full faith in the IHRB, a claim that I'm sure the BHA disagree with in this collaboration in testing horses. He then comes out with the idea that one possible solution to limiting the power of Irish trainers in British races would be to simply close the door to Irish trainers having runners in Britain. He says he would have that across the board, but could understand why it would be a sort of permissible to allow them to have runners at Cheltenham. An extraordinary idea. He's sort of extrapolating this idea that he was in favour of about limiting the, or potentially limiting the number of runners in the Grand National to four per trainer, and blowing it enormously in scale, and suggesting that the best way to stop Irish dominance and to increase British racing's competitiveness and to encourage more of those big owners to stay in Britain would be simply to stop Irish runners being able to come over and compete. So a lot to unpack in a fairly meandering piece that has caused a great deal of consternation among those who have read it, I'd say.
In addition, we know that Dr. Newland has got some previous in this regard as regards his views on what he perceives to be the inadequacy of dope testing in Ireland. And he put that to the test with the BHA, with a number of results that he personally had taken from ex-Irish trained horses a few years ago. He then met with the BHA, who provided their own analytics and their own testing. So Dr. Newland has been vocal on this subject before. Now, Jane Mangan, who is a regular contributor to this podcast and will appear again tomorrow, was moved to send me this note as she was in transit from Ireland to England today. And this is what she had to say in response to Dr. Newland's piece.
Hi, Nick. My apologies for not being able to record the podcast today, but thank you for the platform in which I can respond to Richard Newland's comments on the state of jump racing in Britain, which was published yesterday. Richard Newland's first lines, national hunt racing in Britain is in crisis. There is the hint in itself. Britain is in crisis. But the finger is automatically pointed across the water. And that is something that I and many of my colleagues here at home have taken a little bit of offence to. There's an insinuation on just a third or fourth line, a fourth line that says in his published article, quote, there seems to be an advantage in horses being trained in Ireland. It is not clear what the cause of this advantage is, but the knock-on effect on British jump racing is huge, unquote. You scale down further down the piece. It says, quote, it was also interesting to hear that the earlier BHA statement that they embarked on a new equine anti-doping initiative where 120 Irish horses had out-of-competition testing carried out for the first time jointly with the BHA rather than by the IHRB alone. Unquote. That's inaccurate because the BHA have been travelling over to Ireland to test horses pre-Cheltenham for a number of years now. It was an insult the first time they did it, and it's still an insult today to the integrity of the IHRB, who are under serious scrutiny and have passed every test they have been challenged by. Now, I go on. Richard Newland himself has benefited from a very good Irish horse. He improved a certain Pinot de Ray from a rating of 125 to high 150s after he won the 2014 Aintree Grand National. And lest we forget, if we're going to look inside of the UK industry, the biggest owner in the UK is none other than the Limerick man, JP McManus. But it's no point in there's no benefit to finger pointing here. Britain and Ireland are very much codependent when it comes to national hunt, not only for our market, but for producing horses and racing horses. If one isn't thriving, the other doesn't benefit either, and vice versa. And you can start saying and pointing fingers at, well, Ireland is winning everything and Britain are not. I don't think anybody really benefits from that long term. And I think this is trying to provoke a debate that is not a debate. I think we all need to look within our own circle before we start finger pointing. And I'll quote what I heard at a seminar, a breeding seminar back in January, where somebody says, you look inside your own circle before pointing out. And that was with the view to Irish breeding, rather than looking at France, let's look at ourselves. Well, I'm going to say this with a view to British racing. Rather than looking at us here in Ireland, maybe look a little bit closer to home. Cheltenham maybe exacerbated what has already been happening here in Ireland in terms of Willie Mullins' strength and dominance. But don't forget, Joseph O'Brien, Henry de Bromhead, Gordon Elliott, Gavin Cromwell, and more had winners. This is something that I think was I'm going to say 3 D's. I'm going to think I was disappointed by the entire article published by Dr. Richard Newland. I think he's discredited himself with the suggestion of a blanket ban of Irish runners in the UK. And by saying that, I think he's devalued his word. And at that, I'll finish the note.
All right. That was Jane Mangan. Jonathan Harding, first of all, I've got a couple of things I wanted to say about this. I'm going to let you have first go, though.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I would agree with Jane in the sense that the best way to improve competitiveness in British jump racing is not to look at your nearest neighbours, who obviously provide a lot of the runners and a lot of the competition that you're after, and say, well, we're slightly jealous of where your industry is. We're going to take our ball and go home. Realistically, the best way to improve British racing is to do just that. Make it more appealing for these big owners to have their horses trained here. Make it a more attractive proposition to spectators and to those that are investing in the sport. It's not a case of looking at Ireland and trying to restrict the power of Irish trainers so much as giving British trainers all the correct tools to improve their own lot. I think it's a case of perhaps looking a bit more inwards than outwards on the British and Irish domination front.
Yeah, I think where I agree with Jane most strongly is her point not only about the codependency between the two countries and the historical harmony, but also that you have to look at your own product. And if you were going to take an isolationist policy, and there'll be some people who agree with Richard Newland that it should be Britain first and restricting runners in races to stop domination, there simply aren't enough horses being produced in Britain to sustain a policy like that. There just aren't enough. Fewer and fewer foals are being born every year to national hunt and dual-purpose broodmares in Britain, and there is simply no incentive for the breeders to keep producing them. The system is not set out in a way that incentivizes them. So that just isn't going to work if you're going to be that isolationist and that exclusive. The point where I would deviate slightly from what Jane was saying is that I don't think it's an insult for the BHA to want Irish horses to be tested and for the testing there to meet the BHA's own standards. That's not to suggest that the IHRB don't have standards of their own, but I think the BHA need to give its racing public and the people betting on Cheltenham, for example, and other major fixtures, confidence that horses are all tested to the high standard. I don't think you can be defensive about that. I think you need to applaud that. And if you don't have that, and if you have a discrepancy between the way horses are seen to be tested in both countries or in all countries, that's when you get the hares running. That's when you get speculation, some informed, some less informed. And that's when you will get into the realms of some of the wilder conspiracy theories as well. So all to the good if we want more testing, and all to the good if we want testing that's considered to be significantly robust.
No, I think it's entirely appropriate. It's the fact that it's been formalized is what sort of flagged this, I think. But actually, it makes perfect sense to me that two jurisdictions that rely so heavily on one another, who are interlinked in the way that they are, would have some collaboration and would be singing off the same hymn sheet as far as anti-doping measures are concerned. That to me strikes me as not so much an insult as just something actually quite obvious and quite encouraging to see that you've got two major jurisdictions, and indeed more jurisdictions, are all falling into line in the same way. I think that gives people a lot of faith in the processes.
All right. Well, for the avoidance of doubt, I thought I needed to call the Chief Regulatory Officer from the BHA, Brant Dunshay, just to clear up what the relationship is between Britain and Ireland on dope testing and why there might have been a shift in policy this year, as referenced by Dr. Newland in reference to Julie Harrington's statement, and Jane picked up on it there in her piece. So Brant, where are we now with dope testing horses from Ireland that come to race, particularly somewhere like the Cheltenham Festival or Grand National or wherever, relative to where we were last year or the year before?
Thanks, Nick. Yeah, look, we have tested horses from Ireland and from other jurisdictions certainly for as long as I've been here in Britain, a decade or more. It is a requirement under our rules that international runners are subjected to a different level of testing than our local British runners. And that will vary from one jurisdiction to the other, depending on their status and how we assess their anti-doping rules. Irish trained horses have been tested prior to previous Cheltenham festivals, previous nationals at different times in the past. What's different this year is that we've actually worked collaboratively with the IHRB over the last 12 months to formalise a range of initiatives that we largely have already undertaken. So that includes things like out-of-competition testing, the sharing of information in relation to intelligence. We work with the IHRB on integrity bet monitoring as well. That's all been, you know, well documented. And so this year we got to a point where we felt we could actually formalise that relationship in a way that enabled us to put out the press release we did some weeks ago. And so the testing that went on in the lead up to the Cheltenham Festival was a collaboration. So the IHRB and BHA teams were working together just like when British runners have entries in Ireland, we will undertake testing in Britain of the British trained horses before they run in Ireland. And this is similar to what we've already done with respect to France Gallo. We do it every year in the lead up to Royal Ascot. We will do it in multiple countries where we will facilitate the testing of horses in those jurisdictions.
So what do you say to the idea that's being suggested that the BHA is doing this because it does not have faith in the IHRB's processes?
Nick, I'm the chair of the European Scientific Horse Racing Committee, which is effectively the European Anti-Doping Committee for Horse Racing. I'm currently in Ireland now, where we're running our next three-day meeting. We collaborate extensively with the IHRB, France Gallo, Germany, Italy on anti-doping medication control. We all work to the same standards in terms of harmonisation and testing capabilities. Our laboratory in Britain also provides the testing services for the IHRB and in fact is one of the six laboratories that is an IFHA accredited laboratory. So what I would say is that we work tirelessly to ensure that there is harmonisation and consistency of testing provisions across the European nations and moreover globally.
Now, Brian, let's move on to Wolverhampton last night and the strange case of the restricted rider races. So these races were all restricted to riders who had not ridden more than 30 winners in the past 12 months, and this is the key point, in Britain. So along comes Ben Cohen, very successful Irish rider, who's been in great form and has had north of 50 winners inside the last 12 months. And lo and behold, off he waltzes with a double on the card on Aces Wild, a very well-backed 11-4 favourite for Adrian Wintle, and the 11-10 on shot Lochleen by 4¾ lengths for David Simcock. Rather unfair, it seems. How on earth has that happened?
This is an issue that the industry's racing committee is very conscious of. They've been monitoring it, and my understanding is that this, that in the event that these races, we got to a point where these races were being exploited by riders from foreign jurisdictions, that would be a loophole that they would look to close. And my understanding is that that's a discussion that's happening presently.
All right, so, Ben, I'm trying to add this up on the hoof, but I think he rode 56 winners in the year. So you can't have ridden more than 30 winners in the previous year, is that right?
That's right. That's correct, I understand it. Yeah,
it's not a whole career thing. But if he's ridden 56 winners in the last year, it makes a bit of a mockery of it, doesn't it? And I know you're saying you're going to close the loophole, but if somebody's already seen the loophole, why hadn't it been closed already?
Look, it's a very good point. Obviously, the Racing Committee is an across industry group here, and they make these decisions all the time. I mean, this isn't something that they I think were necessarily anticipating would be commonplace, but they'll deal with it as I understand.
Okay, so you this isn't going to happen again, is it? By the sounds of it,
that is my sense.
Yeah. Okay. So can we put this one down as bit of a cock up? Won't happen again.
I wouldn't necessarily say it's a cock-up. I think they were very mindful of the fact that this was a possibility, but they will work to address the loophole now that it's arisen.
All right. Appreciate your time, Brant. Thank you.
Thanks, Nick.
All right. That was Brant Dunshay, Chief Regulatory Officer for the BHA, as we were speaking, convening a meeting of European regulators on anti-doping. But in the end, we had to talk about this cock-up that took place at Wolverhampton last night. I shouldn't laugh.
Yeah, I mean, you would describe it charitably as unfortunate. I think there's various other words we could use. Cock-up, I think, is fairly appropriate, although Brant Dunshay understandably didn't reach for that one. Look, they sort of, if they knew that this was going to be a possibility, no matter how slim, the door should have been shut firmly on it possibly happening. The fact that it hasn't is a little bit embarrassing, has left a little bit of egg on their faces, but look, it's one of those I'd imagine where you can not laugh it off and be flippant about it, because it's not what this meeting was designed for, and it is somebody taking advantage of the system. But hopefully, as Brandt suggests there, they will sort this loophole ASAP, and something like this won't happen again, because it's not a particularly good look.
To the bigger stage, the international stage, this Dubai card Saturday week looks a serious card, Jonathan. And there was quite a notable statement of intent, I thought, yesterday, just after we uploaded yesterday's podcast, from John and Thady Gosden. What happened?
Yeah, so you mentioned it's a stacked card, and John and Thady Gosden, are sending some seriously talented horses over, and one of those is Emily Upjohn. And we had the news yesterday that Kieran Schumacher will be replacing Frankie Dettori on the dual Group 1 winner. Reason being, Dettori's now based in the US and obviously won't be around for Emily Upjohn's domestic campaign. So the decision's been made there for the sake of continuity for Kieran Schumacher to take that ride. But it's a massive opportunity for him. He's been sort of acting as first jockey for the yard since last autumn. There are a lot of big owners in that yard that have their own retained jockeys, but he's still riding, or is indeed set to ride, a lot of very big horses for the yard going into the flat season proper, as we call it. And they don't come much bigger than Emily Upjohn in the Shima Classic. So it's a really good opportunity for him to really sort of kickstart his chapter now as the first jockey there and really stamp his authority.
I've been speaking to Emily Upjohn's ever enthusiastic co-owner, John Shack, and this is what he had to say as the big day draws closer.
You know, each day it's getting more and more exciting, and I'm just sort of keeping luck on our side, and she travels on Saturday morning, and let's get her there safe and sound, and the humans will follow is my view of it all at the moment. But, you know, tremendous buzz about it all.
And this has been in the cooking for a little while. We spoke about it on the podcast a few months ago. So the John's been thinking about this day for almost since you were forced to draw stumps last year.
It was on the agenda last year, but that cold spell 2 weeks before the race set her back a bit. And the thing about the Gosdens, they're not going to run anything unless they feel that 110% fit and at their peak. And she just wasn't. She was probably 98% there last year. And hopefully sort of in the next sort of 10, 12 days, we'll sort of see, you know, how she is, and hopefully sort of perform well.
And a jockey change. I mentioned it's a sort of slight case of history repeating itself with the Gosdens getting a new jockey. What's your feeling on Kieran Schumacher getting his sort of not his first big opportunity for the yard, because he's ridden classics for the yard, but his first big one this year on such an important horse.
Well, I think the reality is that our Emily Upjohn campaign is hopefully, with luck on our side, going to stretch to next November and the Breeders' Cup. So it's a long campaign. Kieran rides at work at home. So the Gosdens are really thinking about continuity. They've got a new official stable jockey, and it makes sense to sort of keep that consistency.
So would you imagine? So how would you imagine the season might look? I mean, I don't want to tempt fate, because you've had a few ups and downs already. But how would you imagine the season might look, granted a decent slice of luck?
I think sort of. I've not chatted to the trainers at all. You know, I'm renowned for never asking any questions. But I think the calendar is very limited for these Group 1 world champion fillies or mares. So it sort of looks like sort of Coronation Cup again, and maybe the Yorkshire Oaks and the Ark and Breeders' Cup. That sort of feel, you know, keeping everything sort of crossed, fingers and toes crossed. The Ark, obviously, as you know, has been a childhood dream of mine, and closely followed by the Breeders' Cup as well, and just anything in Dubai has always been a dream as well. So I thank the Gosdens and the devoted staff at Clarehaven for putting my dad and I on the global map. It's you know, it's a privilege to have a horse with them.
Now, I note that your trainer and your bloodstock agent, Tom Goff, were half of the racing's deputation to 10 Downing Street to get today, together with ARC Supremo Martin Cruddas and Joe Somerez-Smith, chair of the BHA. Do you have faith in Messrs. Goff and Gosden to deliver the message to government that we need?
Well, I'm not politically aligned, and my dad and I have been Greenbelt activists for decades, where anything any politician has told us has never come about. So I've got a regular dose of cynicism. But Gosden and Goff, the two G's combined, are a formidable force. So hopefully in the next few months there can be a proper debate and decisions from the government. But I hope I'm wrong, but I just feel this government has lost its way on everything, and I just hope there is a priority for the horse racing and breeding industry.
John, thank you for your time today, and I wish you all the best in Dubai. Thanks for talking to us all.
Thank you. Good luck. Bye.
All right, John Shack there. He's got great reason to thank John Gosden, as indeed he has to thank Tom Goff, who brought him Emily up. John, Tom Goff is here now, one of the four men behind the most famous door in the country today, inside number 10 Downing Street. Tom, together with Joe Somerez-Smith, John Gosden, and Martin Cruddas, how did you get in and how did you get on?
Well, it's a long story, but I managed to get a delegation in there back in 2015, Nick, which I think you know about and is well documented, before the first round of levy reforms. I don't know how much of a difference it made, but I don't think it did any harm.
Yeah, it might just be worth reminding everyone, because it's a pretty complicated subject, this. Those levy reforms led to the point of consumption tax being updated, so that if you placed a bet on a British race outside a taxable British territory, i.e. somewhere like Gibraltar, you were going to get subject to levy no matter where that bet was placed. So that kind of closed that offshore loophole.
Absolutely. And it was very important at the time that it went through. Obviously other levy reforms, you know, have been tabled since then, were mentioned in the white paper. But, you know, really in recent months, you know, the noises off all the affordability checks chat that's been going on, I don't think it's been particularly encouraging up until recently. When racing's become a lot more active in the last two or three weeks. I was very pleased to see so much going on at Cheltenham last week, particularly your excellent interview with the gambling minister, Nick. But I just thought it'd be a good idea to try and get another delegation into the policy unit. So fortunately, I did manage to achieve that, and we went along yesterday. And look, we weren't kicking against an open door, but I think that we got a very good audience and a good ear, and a lot of subjects about, you know, levy reform, affordability checks, etc., were covered, and they listened. So I'm very hopeful that the meeting will be acted upon. But, you know, none of us are going to know anything about, you know, any levy reform. Until it all comes out in the wash in April. But hopefully it didn't do any harm, Nick, you know.
And was there a concession on racing's part that the bookmakers have already got some sort of a deal on the table for levy reform, and the ball is now in horse racing's court to try and respond to that deal? Government don't really like assisting or mediating too much in issues to do with levy. Did you get any indication from those close to the Prime Minister that there was any appetite to come to racing's aid at a particularly crucial time?
No, not specifically, no. I can't talk specifically about the meeting in itself, Nick. I'd love to, but we made our points, and Joe Somerez-Smith and Martin Cruddas obviously led on those items that you're referring to. And, you know, I was merely the facilitator of this. So I hope very much that you know, it's part of a general effort that's being made by a number of horse racing constituents that will bear fruit for the industry in the coming months. And I really hope and pray that happens.
You didn't get to see the Prime Minister himself?
No, I'm afraid not, no.
But you got to see senior policy advisors, spin doctors?
Yeah, in a nutshell, yes.
Okay. Well, Tom, I hope that's borne some fruit. We're just talking to John Shack about Emily Upjohn. You pretty hopeful she can go well in Dubai?
Yeah, I'd be very hopeful. I don't want to, you know, queer our pitch by sounding too enthusiastic or making wild predictions, but it's well documented that the filly was. We tried to prepare. Well, John and Thady tried to prepare the filly for the race. Last year in Dubai, the Shima Classic, it's an incredibly valuable race, as you know. It didn't quite work out. She didn't shine. She just didn't respond in some rather challenging weather conditions. And although it's been very wet this winter, it's been a lot milder. And, you know, she appears to be training well so far, but, you know, she's got a ship and everything else. And there's a lot of hoops to jump through before she gets to the starting gate. But she looks great. And, you know, John seems happy. And look, you know, we'll just hope and pray we ship well and get to the church on time, which is really these big international events that the shipping is so important. But she looks marvellous, and I'm very hopeful that she'll give a good account of herself. But it's a red hot race, Nick. You know, we've got August Rodin, we've got the Japanese filly, the Godolphin horse, the one in Qatar. Yeah, this could be the hottest race she runs in all year.
Tom Goff there, and before that, John Shack. They team up with Emily Upjohn, but today, Jonathan Harding, Tom Goff was teaming up with old mucker John Gosden, Joe Somerier-Smith, and Martin Cruddas. I wonder if the foursome were awesome behind the door of Downing Street, or whether this was too little too late for racing.
Yeah, I would take it as encouragement myself. I think it's important that racing continues to bang this drum. If it feels like the point's being laboured, then you need to double down and make this point again, because there is always the concern when it comes to affordability checks and the likely impact on British racing that while members of government, and we had Stuart Andrew at Cheltenham, of course, while members of government are making all the right noises, you never can really take for granted how much they grasp the unintended, I'm sure, consequences of some of this legislation. So the fact that it's another opportunity to just drive that point home has to be a positive. Obviously, racing still weeks away potentially from complete clarity on this. We're hoping for something from the Gambling Commission on its consultation soon enough, but it's one of those that's dragging on, but racing can't afford to get complacent here and has to keep driving it home. So I think that was positive news yesterday, although the cynic in me does wonder how much of an impact those conversations have.
All right, Jonathan, can I give you the three things that have made me most annoyed today?
Please do.
All right, in at three, Aidan Coleman. It's not just jockeys who struggle then, he writes on X. I had absolutely no desire to go near the weighing room, but wanted to see our doctor, and Cheltenham Races wouldn't let me in. Very embarrassing. By the way, this is a guy who's been off since last summer with one of the worst knee injuries you'll ever seen, and who has been desperately trying to recover to get back to the saddle. That's not good.
No, that is disappointing. It's important for trainers and indeed jockeys to be there from simply a networking perspective as much as the fact they ought to be there anyway, because it's our big show and they're the ones that are doing it all year round. So yeah, disappointing to hear. Hopefully that one's not an issue next year.
In at two, Stuart Andrew, the sports minister, who I interviewed last week at Cheltenham, again on Twitter. Football clubs are vital community assets, and for long, some fans have been taken for granted and clubs lost to unscrupulous owners. Sound familiar? Today's bill will create an independent football regulator, ushering in greater protections to help clubs and their fans thrive over the long term. He loves to protect everybody from themselves, does the current Conservative sports minister. Football clubs are vital community assets. If only he realised what vital community assets racecourses and racing stables were, and realised it in a bit more detail, then perhaps his opinion on certain aspects of the white paper would be somewhat different, And of course, he says that he'll create an independent football regulator. How long before we're being asked to create an independent horse racing regulator? Because we can't protect our sport from ourselves, Jonathan.
Well, it's certainly a lot to unpack there. Hopefully it was driven home to him in no uncertain terms at Cheltenham, just how much, just how large a part that yards and racecourses play in their local communities. I'm sure he's been told several times, and I would hope he's fully aware of that.
And things that annoyed me, number one, ad-free cities. A massive win in Sheffield as the council votes to ban harmful ads for airlines, airports, fossil fuel-powered cars, including hybrids, fossil fuel companies, and gambling. The council in Sheffield has voted to ban harmful ads on gambling. But yeah, if they're also banning ads for hybrid cars, then, you know, I give up, to be honest.
That one feels a little bit like overreach to me. The idea that gambling is innately as destructive as fossil fuel industry is beyond me. But there we are.
Okay. Did you read Patrick Mullins's column? Well, of course you did, because it's in your own paper.
I did indeed, yeah.
I was most interested to read his comments about the Cheltenham Festival, where he says it was an incredible week. I felt great pride at Willie making 100, but I do feel embarrassment at our success too. Cheltenham shouldn't really be like this, and the winners before felt different, better. Maybe you shouldn't say that. Maybe you can't say that, but it's the truth. Now, why do you think they felt better before?
It's difficult to say, isn't it? I think he's probably speaking a little bit to the, without putting words into his mouth, I think the fact that sort of it's expected now of Willie Mullins to have these winners, perhaps that's a little bit more, not routine, I don't think it would ever go as far as routine, but there is a certain pressure and a certain expectation that he will just turn up and have winners. That might take a little bit of the gloss off of it. I know there's been a great deal written and said about attendances in the last few days. Perhaps atmosphere's got a part to play as well. It was really interesting to read his thoughts and particularly on sort of novices and handicaps as well. He certainly wasn't towing the party line as far as the yard's concerned, because a few of his suggestions perhaps would actually hamper Willie Mullins having winners. But yeah, it was an interesting column, and that point stood out to me as well. It was quite eye-opening that it feels slightly different to him now.
Well, it's all change in France in terms of the administration of French racing, because France Gallo, the governing body, has recently changed its president and changed its chief executive. You'll remember the former chief executive has got to come back to Arcana. Olivier Deloire was a regular guest on the programme, and he has been replaced. So what major tasks face his successor? Well, joining me now, Adrien Cugnas from Jour de Gallo. Adrien, tell me a little bit about who has taken over from Olivier Deloire and what their credentials are.
So the new CEO of France Gallo is called Eliano. He's not French, he's from Belgium, but he's made his career in banking and insurance in France, in Paris. And he used to be a pageantry rider, so champion amateur rider. So he faces many challenges in the fact that for the last 4 months, the betting turnover is going a bit down, and it's a bit concerning in France because prize money is directly linked with betting turnover. Also, there is always a challenge of creating more owners, and more especially domestic owners, because French industry relies probably too much on foreign racing owners. And the last thing is that at the minute in France, following the farm strikes, there is a debate with the government about VAT, and there is a chance that racing owners will have a reduced VAT back to 5%. So it is possible. It is not a battle already won, but it's a process on the making. And so the CEO and all the members of the board of France Gallo are actually working at the minute with the French government to see if they can have, like, over farming activities, a low VAT tax.
So Eleanor has got a bulging in tray already. How will history judge Olivier Deloire, do you think? He had quite a long tenure at France Gallo for a job of that nature.
Absolutely. I think that when he started, he was giving the unpleasant job of cost killing, which is not the greatest way to be popular. When he started in France, I would say the financial situation of the racing body was not great, and with his team, they did a quite good job. But it was obviously a bit painful because they have to reduce the labor force, I would say, of the racing body. And after that, I think they have to survive all the COVID situation where racing was almost stopped, and they have been politically enough influential to negotiate with the government that racing could take over, and he probably saved quite a few companies in terms of especially trainers that couldn't have survived without racing. And the last is that for years, if not decades, we have this problem of the lack of attendance, and especially young people at races in France. And one time per week during spring and summer, they've created these massive parties in Longchamp. And if you talk with people that are racing for decades, they told you that they never have seen biggest crowd in Paris at the races outside the Arc. So this is a massive success, probably something that not many people believed it would happen, but something is probably happening in terms of crowds in Paris for Gallop.
Adrien, thanks so much. We look forward to seeing how Monsieur Hinault gets on.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Adrien Cugnas there, and from the banks of the Seine to Kowloon Harbour, here's J.A. McGrath with all the latest from Hong Kong.
Nick, it's a massive week in Hong Kong racing. This weekend sees the running of the Hong Kong Derby. We all know about Hong Kong's big international races in December and the important Champions Day in April featuring the QE2 Cup. But for local owners, there is one race above all that they want to win, the Derby. Hong Kong owners bask in the glory of classic success if lucky enough or skillful enough or rich enough to own the winner, and the post-race parties are legendary. Some great storylines this year: Helios Express, a favourite, and the winner of the first two legs of the four-year-old Triple Crown, was under a fitness cloud last week. He had an infection, but he galloped a chart in on Monday and has been passed fit to run by the stewards. Ryan Moore is flying in from Sydney, where he partners Storm Boy for Coolmore and Partners in the Golden Slipper at Rose Hill on Saturday. Ryan rides Ensued for John Size in the Hong Kong Derby on Sunday. Ensued is an ex-James Fanshawe horse who was placed in a decent novice at Salisbury as a juvenile. Zach Purton prepares for his 14th Hong Kong Derby ride. He'll be aboard Massive Sovereign for trainer Dennis Yip. Massive Sovereign is an ex-Ballydoyle youngster trained by Aidan O'Brien, known then as Broadhurst. He's impressed locals since arriving in Hong Kong. He bolted in recently at Cha Tin. He loves 2,000 metres, the mile and a quarter, and is expected to have the right temperament for the big occasion. And the most noteworthy item, in my opinion, Blake Shin flying in from Melbourne to partner Galaxy Patch for Pierre Ng in a track gallop at Cha Tin last Monday. He was pleased with what he saw and felt, and he's back to ride the horse that we all thought was a top-line sprinter in the making. Now he's having a crack at 2,000 metres. As I say, there's only one Hong Kong Derby. Meanwhile, there are 9 races at Happy Valley today. It's a pretty challenging card. I thought the best on the day was in race 5, number 6, Super Charizard, who's a 3-year-old from New Zealand, and he's trained by first-season trainer Mark Newnham. Now, Super Charizard had a really checkered passage in his first experience on race day. He got knocked from pillar to post, and yet he still battled on for a reasonable 6 just behind the place getters. It was a good run, and he's well thought of. Race 5, number 6, Super Charizard, to beat number 10, Dan Attack. take them in a toad swinger. Later on in race 6, number 3, Gallant Valor should be a good thing for Zach Purton. And in the finale, race 9, number 11, Wings of War. You'll remember this one was with Clive Cox. He won the Millreave Stakes Group 2 at Newbury in his juvenile year. Well, he's taken a bit of time to hit his traps in Hong Kong. He's 0 from 11, but I think that he's ready to win. Race 9, number 11, Wings of War. That's all on the Hong Kong Beat this week. I'll have more for you next week.
Right, thank you to all my guests today. Jonathan Harding is still with me in what's been a rather tetchy episode. Jonathan, have you got something to cheer us up?
The tip today is Double Powerful in the 5.15 at Market Raisin for Neil Mulholland. Beat an odds-on shot quite nicely at Fakenham last time and looks open to loads and loads of improvement. So that is Double Powerful.
Jonathan, thank you very much. Thank you very much for listening. That was Wednesday, March the 20th. We'll see you again tomorrow. Bye for now.
You've been listening to Nick Luck Daily, brought to you by Timeform, the trusted source of racing data and analysis, by the Racehorse Owners Association, and by the Racing App in partnership with FitStairs.